DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. We're taking a pause from normal programming this week and activating the Inside Europe Care Package. Basically, it's our pick of the most hopeful and inspiring stories from our ongoing Other Europe series. We have the Italian city where each and every baby is automatically a citizen, the British Intergenerational Nursery Project where age is never an issue, and the young Irish filmmaker on a deeply personal mission to highlight marginalised communities. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. So many important things are happening around the world at the moment, and Europe, not to mention Germany, is of course no exception. We'll be back with our usual coverage next week. This week, however, we're giving ourselves and our listeners a pause as we share with you our pick of the inspiring and hopeful stories that we've been sharing as part of our ongoing Other Europe series. I wanted to start with Danny Mitzman's piece, Bolognese from the Very First Day. It's a story that stuck with me as an inspiring reminder of the protective power that civic structures can have, even at a time when national structures are hostile to migrants. It's also the story with which we began our Other Europe series back in June. Here is what we said then. One thing that we noticed when we started collecting these stories is that most of them, in one way or another, were about belonging. In the case of our first story, that's particularly clear. It comes to us from the Italian city of Bologna, a medieval university town with a reputation for progressive values. Whilst Italy, under far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, has pursued an anti-migrant agenda, curtailing migrants' special protection and cracking down on residence permits, Bologna has taken a different tack. As a city, Bologna has replaced ius sanguinis, the right of blood, with ius soli, the right of the soil. That means that any child born in Bologna is considered a Bolognese citizen, irrespective of where their parents originally came from. It's a simple but radical idea, and one which our Bologna-based reporter, Danny Mitzman, was all too happy to investigate for us.
If you come to Piazza Maggiore, Bologna's central square, and look up at the old town hall, you'll see a huge red banner across the top of the main entrance that says Bolognesi dal primo giorno, Bolognese from the first day. When Matteo Lepore was elected mayor in 2021, this was, he says, an essential part of his vision. Within a matter of months, the council had voted to amend the municipal charter, granting honorary citizenship to all children of non-Italian parents resident in Bologna.
We have a million of people in our country that pay taxes, they work in our cities, they contribute to our community, but they can't vote. So it's difficult to say to these people that their son or daughter are not Italians.
There is a paradox in ius sanguinis. Even if you've never set foot in Italy, don't speak the language, but have an Italian parent, you can get automatic citizenship and be able to vote, while someone who's lived here all their life can't. So the motivation behind the amendment is simple.
The idea that everyone who arrives in Bologna or grew up in Bologna has the right to be citizens of our town, so we call Bolognese from the first day, or Italian. It's also a campaign for citizenship. So the idea that Bologna, as a progressive city, promote a national campaign for citizenship and a new law in the parliament.
Something which the mayor says is a long way off.
Italy is scared by the people from other countries, especially from Africa or Asia. The color of the skin is an institutional racism. And the far right is so present in the culture of the country and the institutional system. And also the left, the center left, when they had the opportunity to reform the law, they didn't.
According to statistics published by Save the Children, there are more than 870,000 school children in Italy who don't hold citizenship, around 70% of whom were born here. That's why the Bolognese amendment specifies another concept, jus scholae, the right of school.
The Bolognese jus soli, as I call, is a mix of jus soli and jus scholae, because we are open to the people who arrive in the city, but also the people born in the city. If a young person has the idea that Italy will be his future, I think he will invest on our country and not think that it's the country that don't want him or her.
La questione che abbiamo oggi andremo a creare un inchiostro che una volta si utilizzava.
An after-school club on the outskirts of the city. Although it's open to anyone, almost all the kids who come here for free activities, a snack and help with their homework are from immigrant families.
My name is Isha and I'm 15 years old and I was born in Pakistan. I'm come in 2019 in Italy.
Isha's father's been in Italy for 20 years and has applied for citizenship, but is still waiting.
Nella mia classe c'è 5 marocchini e 3 albanesi.
Listing the different nationalities in her class, she says some have citizenship while others, like her, don't.
E in Italia c'è ancora il razzismo.
In Italy, there's still racism and they still don't trust people with different citizenship from them.
14-year-old Gorshan was born in Bologna to Indian parents.
My father moved here 20 years ago, my mother 16 years ago.
Gorshan obtained Italian citizenship last year.
In my opinion, it's not fair. If you're born in France, even if your parents are foreign, you're considered French. I think the same should happen in Italy and other countries.
Ciao, io sono Arish.
I'm Arish, I'm 17 years old, I was born here in Bologna.
When his parents were granted Italian citizenship, Arish was able to request it too and became a citizen 2 years ago.
When I had to go anywhere, I would always automatically get asked for my residency permit, and it still happens to me now, because everyone thinks that if you don't look Italian, you must have a residency permit because you can't be Italian. But I think you should be Italian if you were born here. We are in 2024, and the laws can't stay as they were. They need to change. They should give citizenship to people born here and not make them wait years to get it.
Young people whose parents aren't citizens currently have a one-year window when they turn 18 to apply for citizenship. The process is riddled with bureaucratic complexities and potential obstructions, which Matteo Lepore considers institutionalized racism.
I think it's a very long trip to arrive at the end of the process. You have to ask the citizenship at 18, but the reply arrived 5-6 years after. So it's very, very long. It's not incentivated. And I think a right is a right. If you have a right, you have to obtain the right in the moment, not after 6 years.
Casa tua si è mai parlato di permesso di soggiorno per poter stare in un paese?
Since launching the campaign, the city's organised events, inviting musicians, activists, actors, writers and influencers to discuss the theme. Although Bolognese citizenship is symbolic, the mayor says it can still help sensitise the whole community, raising awareness of the demographically outdated law and the evolution of Italian society. Danny Mitzman, DW, Bologna.
Grazie soprattutto al Comune di Bologna!
My next pick of our Other Europe series is also rooted in the idea of community and belonging, but I will be honest, I picked it really for its cuteness. So let's join our UK reporter Lucy Taylor once again as she joins a group of nursery children for a good old morning sing-along. Listen carefully though, because all may not be quite as it seems.
So are we ready? In and out the dusty bluebells, in and out the dusty bluebells, in and out the dusty bluebells, will you be my partner?
For these 3 and 4-year-olds, it's an everyday sing-along. But if you listen closely, you might hear some different voices joining in.
Should we do it a bit faster? In and out the dusty bluebells, in and out the dusty bluebells, in and out the dusty bluebells.
The children have taken playtime out of their usual classroom along the road and into the lounge at the care home around the corner.
And they're old people too.
It was the idea of the nursery's manager, Emily Steele.
We're a nursery in Sheffield, and we really do believe that all the social skills are the foundations for them being able to learn and regulate their emotions, and they learn so much for being out in the big wide world. So we wanted to build that and bring some happy to the residents at the nursing home too. So we've set up this really lovely relationship, and now we're going there every Monday.
Old MacDonald had a farm, E-I-E-I-O.
This week is one of the best so far. About 10 residents have come to join in. They're sitting in lounge chairs around the circle of children on the floor.
I mean, the nursing home have fed back to us that they're getting more residents down there than they expected, which is really nice. But then we've also had weeks where we've had residents who the care workers have been really surprised at because they've come to life and they've done all this joining in that they've never seen them do.
And on that farm he had a
lamb.
What does a lamb sound like?
They hope that mixing the generations can help the children to understand the world better and give the older people a connection to their community and something to look forward to.
They love it, yeah. They're talking about it all week after they've been, and the kids are teaching them songs and even sign language and things.
Catherine Ferris is the manager at the care home.
Having a really good turnout, to be honest. We've got quite a few people that historically were teachers, so they really enjoy having the children come in. Quite a lot of people who grew up in the local area, so they've lived in Totley all their lives, so they're just really keen to, you know, see the children that are growing up in the area as well. So, yeah, it's really nice. It's one of our most popular activities.
What do you think about having the children here? Have you enjoyed it?
Lovely. Yeah. Yes, every time they come. We love seeing them, yes. Yes, we all enjoy it as well, yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes, we all enjoy it, definitely. Look forward to them coming.
Wind the bobbin up, wind the bobbin up, pull, pull, clap, clap, clap.
And even with so many former teachers, it's not just the children who are learning. The class are teaching their new older friends sign language and new songs, and showing them all the other things they found out about the world.
I think that's the beautiful thing about children this age. They just want to play. They don't care if you're 75 or 5. They just want to get to know you. Last week when we went, we took our caterpillars that were growing, and they were walking around giving all the residents high fives, showing them the caterpillars, chatting away. They're just so unfazed. They're just such a beautiful age to bring some happiness to somebody's day.
The groups hope their pioneering project will show everyone that you're never too old for new friends. Lucy Taylor, DW, in the UK.
Bye-bye, Mrs.
Goodbye, Mrs. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. One of my biggest pleasures this year has been producing a series highlighting the voices of European ambassadors to the One Young World Summit in Montreal. Remember the Finnish founder of an app that works like Tinder but for good deeds? Or the marine biologist turned sustainable tourism pioneer? Or perhaps you remember him, the young filmmaker whose background growing up below the poverty line in post-conflict Northern Ireland has propelled him to seek out and portray marginalised voices in his films. I'll let him introduce himself again in his own words.
I
Hi everyone, my name is Austin Tomás O'Rahilly. I am an Irish young filmmaker and activist. So on the film side, I like to make short films to tackle social issues because I think that's really powerful. And then on the activism side, I've worked since I was young in youth work and then transitioned into lobbying on the children's human rights front to advocate for children's human rights here in the north of Ireland, Northern Ireland. I grew up below the poverty line in post-conflict north of Ireland, Northern Ireland. It was difficult growing up in a housing estate with limited funding. You know, my mother's a single mother with a disability, unable to work. So I think those feelings of facing difficulty, and also my own difficulties with regards to growing up with a disability, having a speech impediment and sort of feeling voiceless because of that, I think that ingrained in me a sense of wanting to fight for justice, fight for young people's empowerment, and see stories on screen that I can relate to and that I think other people need to hear. The highest qualified person in my life as I was growing up was a window cleaner. You know, no one in my family had went to university. And so I think there is sort of a low expectation or limit of expectation that you, in a sense, set on yourself because you can't see the other opportunities, and also a limit on success that society sets on you. But also the practicalities of it's very difficult to think about doing these things when you don't have the money to do them. And, you know, it's more about survival to the weak. I was lucky in a sense that I went to a very good school that really supported me. You know, I had such low confidence that, you know, I was fighting my school to try and drop out of my English literature class because I felt I wasn't good enough. And I really had low confidence in my academic abilities. And it was a really incredible teacher called Miss Fitzgerald, actually, that fought with me in the most loving and in kind way and sort of tried to say, actually, no, you can do it. You have wonderful capacity. I believe in you and you have to believe in yourself. I also, because I have a disability, I had a wonderful classroom assistant who again helped me engage in education in a way that I couldn't have myself. And, you know, I always look back and say, if it wasn't for Miss McColgan, my classroom assistant, I would not have made it through school. I also engaged in wonderful youth services that showed me ways that I can empower myself and lobby and advocate for children's human rights. With children's youth services and incredible youth workers, I never would have got into that field because I wouldn't have even known how to navigate those spaces. And then finally, when it comes to filmmaking, there's a wonderful scheme here called the BFI Film Academy, which I took part in many years ago when I was still a young child. I was 16 years old. And that really, again, brought me into a space that felt so foreign, because it is one thing to love film and see it as a powerful mode, both of escapism and storytelling that reflects yourself, and seeing it is really powerful. There's another thing in believing that you can actually do it. And the BFI Film Academy showed me that space and gave me the tools to navigate the big world of storytelling, to actually see that no matter what your economic or socio-economic background is, you actually can succeed in film. It's going to be very difficult, and there are significant structural barriers, but the BFI Film Academy is a wonderful scheme, because I can tell you that had I not done that scheme, I would not be where I was at today. I like to tell stories about the most marginalised in societies, those whose stories have not been told. I think it can be incredibly frustrating when you see media and you don't relate to it at all. You know, I tell the story about I was watching a film when I was young about a family falling down in really hard times, and the new house that they had to go into because of these really difficult financial times was about four times the size of my house, and immediately I don't feel seen by that. I can't relate to it. You know, I like to tell stories that are authentic, and so, you know, I've done films tackling domestic violence, poverty, the impacts of imprisonment and reform, young people's mental health, and I'm currently working on a film and seeking funding for a film that I'm really proud of called Cost, which is sort of exploring the impact of repressed childhood sexual abuse. So it is a very difficult subject, but I'm really proud of the script. It's been shortlisted on some film festivals here in Ireland, screenplay competitions. And so I'm seeking funding for that right now, which is always a challenge. The Good Friday Agreement was in 1998, 10th of April 1998. I was born 1st of April 2000. I was growing up, I guess, for a lack of a better term, in a post-conflict society where there was significant poverty, where there was significant trauma that affected many people growing up in that environment. You know, my granny would tell a story about how she would get my mother to clean her room, would be to sew up and say, pick up your underwear from the floor, the soldiers might be raiding tonight. That was how normalised that violence was in the town, that to get your child to pick up the underwear from her room, we'd be talking about soldiers raiding the house. The peace process is still moving forwards and backwards. We still have to be building relationships. I think we're in an incredibly good place. I think we're in a very hopeful place. But of course, I think those experiences do impact you. Again, I tell the story of how normalised it was. I was walking with my mother on the street in the early 2000s, and there was another bomb scare. The conversation wouldn't be, I'm filled with fear by this bomb scare. Rather, it was that annoyance of, oh, I can't believe that this is happening again. We have to walk the long way around. So I think it did shape me in many ways, but I'm really proud of where I come from. I'm proud of where we are. I'm proud that now, in the north of Ireland, Northern Ireland, you know, if I'm born in one hospital, I can proudly be proud of my national identity. And if another person is born in the, you know, the exact same hospital in the exact same area, they can be proud of their British identity. And, you know, we can both have, I have my Irish passport, they have their British passport, but we both respect each other, we respect each other's identities. We have more progress to happen, but I do think it's a wonderful place.
The filmmaker Oisin Thomas O'Reilly there, a child of the Good Friday Agreement, which brought peace to the island of Ireland. Our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. Please do use it. We really do enjoy reading your mails and are, of course, as always, grateful for likes, comments and reviews via the various podcast platforms. Also a reminder, of course, that you can also find our sister podcast, Living Planet, on all the usual platforms. Go there for coverage of COP29. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Dum, This is Inside Europe and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Early last year, we ran a Kafka special to coincide with the opening of the Franz Kafka Making of an Icon exhibition at the Bodleian Libraries in Oxford. Well, that very same exhibition is about to open again in New York, where it can be seen from November 2022 through to April of next year at the Morgan Library and Museum on Madison Avenue. So, dear US listeners, here is a taste of what to expect. This is how our special began. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. I'm really sorry. Ed, would you just mind bearing with me for a moment? You see, I'm a bit stressed, actually. I've received this summons from the editorial office, you see, and I'm not sure who issued it, but it does look quite official. So I better go check it out. Oh, I don't know. Apparently I've done something, or maybe not done something. It wasn't quite clear, to be honest. But I'm sure that I can find someone who can help. Now all the doors are shut. Ah, maybe behind this door. Oh, that is one big insect in the corner there. And it's looking at me with really sad eyes. Hang on, this is all ringing a bell.
A man comes from the country, begging admittance to the law. But the guard cannot admit him. Can he hope to enter at a later time? That is possible, says the guard. The man tries to peer through the entrance. He had been taught that the law should be accessible to every man. Do not attempt to enter without my permission, says the guard. I am very powerful, yet I am the least of all the guards. From hall to hall, door after door, each guard is more powerful than the last.
Oh, I get it. This must have to do with the Kafka centenary. On June 3rd, it will be 100 years since the death of Franz Kafka, one of the most influential writers in the German language, indeed in any language. And that is obviously something that the shadowy editorial office has decided we need to mark with a half-hour Kafka special. Actually, as you've probably guessed, there is no editorial office, and I am very excited about what is to come. To help me pick my way through the life, work, and significance of an author who has been very much on my mind of late, I was joined a little earlier in the month by two very special guests ahead of the opening of a new exhibition at the Bodleian Libraries in Oxford titled Kafka, Making of an Icon. I'll let them introduce themselves.
Hello, I'm Caroline Duttlinger. I'm a professor of German literature and culture at Oxford University and one of the co-directors of the Oxford Kafka Research Centre.
I'm Richard Ubenden. I'm Bodley's librarian, which means I'm the chief executive of the Bodleian Libraries and also head of gardens, libraries and museums in the University of Oxford.
I would love to begin by asking you both to share with me your first memories of your engagement with Kafka. Caroline, when was the first time that you picked up a piece of Kafka's writing? What can you tell me about that first encounter?
Yeah, so I first read Kafka when I was probably about 17. My best friend, who was at a different school, was studying the Metamorphoses. And I read it and I was absolutely riveted. I'd just never read anything like this before.
One morning, when Gregor Samsa woke from troubled dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a horrible vermin. He lay on his armor-like back, and if he lifted his head a little, he could see his brown belly, slightly domed and divided by arches into stiff sections. The bedding was hardly able to cover it and seemed ready to slide off any moment. His many legs, pitifully thin compared with the size of the rest of him, waved about helplessly as he looked.
I think I was 17 as well, actually, and I think it was the public library in my small town which I was working my way through the shelves. And I read The Metamorphosis as well and was just, you know, struck by how kind of weird it was, how kind of unusual and dark. And then I think I didn't read The Trial for a long time, but I did watch the Orson Welles film when I was at university.
I noticed that your examining magistrate has just given some of you a secret sign. Well, I don't know whether that sign was meant to be a signal for applause or hissing, but I hereby publicly empower the examining magistrate to address his hired agents out loud. Let him say hiss now or clap now, whatever he wants. Can there be any doubt that behind my arrest, a vast organization is at work? An establishment which contains a retinue of civil servants, officers, police, and others, perhaps even hangmen.
And it was really then coming to Oxford and finding, when I arrived in 2003, that one of the collections that I was responsible as the keeper of special collections was the Kafka archive here. And we were in the throes of all sorts of negotiations and discussions around it with scholarly projects from, you know, rival German publishers, that the whole complexity and interest and fascination and kind of compelling cultural story, as well as the you know, the literature itself around Kafka, came really home to me.
Well, this sounds like the perfect place for me to ask you about the archive, because it's not just any archive. The Bodleian Libraries hold the majority of Franz Kafka's papers, and this is including significant first manuscripts. How did that come about?
Well, the Kafka archive really, you know, the story is so compelling and interesting. I mean, in my view, it escaped destruction perhaps four times. So Kafka himself destroyed part of his own papers while he was alive, but also gave instructions to Max Brod, his great friend and literary executor, to destroy his papers after he died. And Brod refused to do that or disobeyed those instructions. And there are various kind of theories around why and what the justification for doing that was. But he did disobey those instructions. And then Brod fled Prague in 1939, you know, on the cusp of the Nazi takeover. So that's number two. Number three is being in Tel Aviv, where Max Brod fled, and during the various Arab-Israeli conflicts, the risk of them being destroyed as kind of collateral damage was real. And so they were moved to a Swiss bank account, or a bank vault rather than a bank account, sorry. And then it was from there that they moved to Oxford. And that process came about because of one of Kafka's family members, one of the nieces of Franz Kafka, who had survived the Holocaust, where most of the rest of his family had been murdered in the camps, had come to London. Her son had come to Oxford as an undergraduate and had a chance encounter with a great Oxford professor, which had then led to the transfer of the archive from Switzerland, from the bank vault in Switzerland, to the Bodleian Library for, say, scholarly access. So both that kind of combination of safekeeping, but also ease of access for the scholarly work that the professor of German here wanted to embark on. And I think this exhibition that we are about to open, and which Caroline has been one of the co-curators for, is to some extent a culmination of all of that lengthy period of movement of the archive, its preservation, but also the growing sense of Kafka as a world writer and the libraries around the world, which are fortunate enough to be stewards of the physical legacy of Kafka's work, to be part of a collaborative movement to share them with the world.
And that exhibition, which opens on May 30th, has the title The Making of an Icon. But before we talk about the making of an icon, I want to feel that we've got a grip on who Kafka actually was. Caroline, can you give me a sort of a thumbnail sketch of Franz Kafka? Who was he?
Right, so Kafka was born in 1883 in Prague to German-speaking Jewish parents. The parents were quite aspirational. They'd moved out of the ghetto They set up their own business, which was a haberdashery shop. They were very upwardly mobile. They moved around several times during Kafka's childhood. Kafka was quite a sensitive child, and famously, he didn't get on very well with his father, who was a very assertive, confident man who'd made his way in the world, and I think was always a bit disappointed that Kafka had these literary inclinations and didn't really have the instinct of a businessman. And so Kafka then goes to university in Prague. After school, he studies law. He gains a doctorate in law. And then after that, he becomes an insurance lawyer. So his first role is with an Italian insurance institute, and then his ongoing job is with the Workers' Accident Insurance Institute. So in other words, Kafka's daytime job was an office job, and in his diaries and letters, he endlessly complains about the office and how he hates it. But it has to be said, by modern standards, he actually had quite a nice arrangement. So he started work at 8 a.m., but he was finished at 3. He'd then go home, take a nap, and then after the parents and his younger sisters, with whom he shared a flat, had gone to bed, he would start writing, and often wrote till about 2 in the morning. And so this was basically Kafka's life. He was an insurance lawyer by day and an author by night. Kafka had quite a difficult personal life, so the relationship with his father was difficult. He got engaged 3 times, but he never married. And then in 1917, in the middle of the First World War, he wasn't drafted because his occupation was on a reserved list. But in 1917, he then suffered a nocturnal hemorrhage and was diagnosed with tuberculosis a few months later. He took early retirement in the early 1920s, and then he died on the 3rd of June 1924, just 1 month before his 41st birthday.
And he's left us with a nerve that is so distinctive and surprising that it's left us with an adjective, Kafkaesque. What do you both understand? I'd love to put this question to both of you, because I suspect that it's a question that has a shifting answer. What do you understand by the word Kafkaesque? Caroline, maybe you could respond first.
So if you look it up in the dictionary, in the Oxford English Dictionary, for instance, it will just say, in the manner of the works of Franz Kafka, which is, of course, basically a cop-out because they don't really want to answer the question. I think people generally associate it with, on the one hand, kind of sinister, overbearing institutions and authorities, also a sort of overbearing bureaucracy, and on the other hand, maybe a sense that life suddenly takes a turn towards something more surreal or grotesque. So maybe that subtle sense of being alienated from the ordinary course of events. So I think it's both. It's both the theme of power and authority and like labyrinthine institutions, but it's also more of a feeling, maybe a mood that pervades Kafka's writings.
Richard nodded there.
Yeah, I think that's very good. I think I'd like to kind of add on to that, though, a sense of individuals facing bureaucracy where it's unfathomable and where decisions are not transparent or clear, and where navigating through bureaucracies or administrative hurdles of various kinds seem, you know, not just daunting, but sort of almost the sheer impossibility of knowing what the right answer or what the right questions to put to such a system are.
And I think what Kafka depicts really well, especially in The Trial and also The Castle, is this sense that there is this almost web of bureaucracy, but there is no one person in charge. So you can never trace this back to one individual who's the architect of all of that. It's sort of weirdly dispersed, and no one quite knows who's in charge. No one quite knows who's given them the order. So it's a system that sort of self-perpetuates. And again, I think that really taps into the current mood, that we don't know who sets the algorithms on social media that feed us this stuff. The second point maybe that makes Kafka so relevant for today is his interest in surveillance, which is very, again, powerful both in The Trial and The Castle. The sense that actually surveillance is not something, again, done by an individual or a particular authority. It's sort of almost embedded in society and how people relate to each other.
I'm so glad you mentioned algorithms, Caroline, because there have been two particular stories in recent years that have made me think of Kafka. One's been a UK example. That's been the revelations that have come out about the prosecution of innocent postmasters who had been falsely accused of embezzlement. And in the background was a new computer system, which was actually responsible for the faults, but nobody was allowed to question the computer system. The other case was in the Netherlands, where there was a child benefit scandal, which caused untold suffering to parents, often from immigrant backgrounds, who had been falsely identified by an algorithm as being guilty of misclaiming child benefits. What is the meaning of Kafka in an age where algorithms have been mixed in with existent bureaucracy?
Yeah, I mean, of course, Kafka lived long before the advent of computers, although interestingly, Orson Welles, in his great film adaptation, does have a scene with a great computer. So Wells sort of juxtaposes Kafka's early 20th century Habsburg world with the post-war, Cold War sort of technocratic society.
One of those electronic gimmicks?
Yes.
That can give you the answer to anything?
Yes.
Well
what?
You want to know about your case, don't you? Ask the machine.
But I think even though Kafka doesn't foresee this kind of technological age we're living in now, he does already hint at it by depicting these abstract institutions. So you've got the court, the law, the castle, who are never clearly defined. They don't have a physical manifestation. They are just abstract concepts. And they seem to function almost divorced from human characters in Kafka stories. So there is this sense that the court has a life of its own that you can't question. There's a famous scene in the trial where Joseph K. tries to understand his case and talks to a priest, and the priest says this crucial sentence, which is, "The court wants nothing from you. It receives you when you arrive, and it releases you when you go." The court doesn't really actively pursue, it doesn't have an agenda, there's no vendetta or persecution. But actually, it's quite a chilling comment, because it implies that the court is just part of your life and there's no way of getting away from that. I was recently in a radio program where they interviewed Alan Bates, one of the postmasters, about the question whether his case reminds him more of Kafka or of Orwell, and he said both. But what he stressed was this sense that there was no one malign person who was going after you. It was just like hitting a wall. So once again, it's the algorithms taking over, which means that there's no one to blame at the end of the day and no one you can turn to, which I assume was also the case with the Dutch example that you mentioned, Kate.
That's so interesting. When I sort of listened back to my own question in the way that I phrased it, I think I was still very much in a paradigm where I was thinking very much of fixed institutions, you know, encounters with fixed, usually state-linked institutions. And your answers have sort of shown me that sort of locus of the Kafkaesque has always been much more diffuse than that.
Well, I think this is really interesting, because in the library at the moment, we have a project to try to develop an archive of social media. And I think that algorithms, if you log on to X or Facebook or whatever, are there because of surveillance. And that digital surveillance is monitoring your every move online. And the actions that you make online are build up profiles of each of us, which are then traded by specialist companies whose business model is to build up those profiles and then to sell them mostly to other commercial entities or to advertising brokers in order to, you know, customize advertising. But increasingly, it's being used in the political sphere to target political advertising. But increasingly, the sense that the algorithms update and develop themselves, that they require less and less human intervention, that they have a life of their own to some extent, is one aspect of contemporary society that I think a lot of individuals find deeply troubling and concerning.
Well, she needs the data, economic, sociological, psychological. Still, she might be able to handle it. She screens and processes personality tests. But first, an awful lot of material would have to be fed to her.
It's a she.
That's the way the experts talk about it.
I see, like for a car or a boat, kind of affectionate.
Well, respectfully, more than that.
And I think what Kafka shows so nicely in his novels is how there are no fixed boundaries between institutions. And it's this sort of like spilling over of like authoritarian structures beyond just one individual institutional authority. So the way that, for instance, in the trial, every single person Kay meets turns out to be somehow connected to the court. The court invades his workspace. So this sense that boundaries are somehow no longer relevant, that you can no longer point to a particular like pathway, as Richard says, to like file a complaint. So in the trial, he tries to pursue those pathways. He goes to court, he gives an impassioned speech, he makes a complaint, but it never really leads anywhere. It sort of leads to other unintended consequences. So ultimately, what makes the court and the castle so powerful is how the characters, the protagonists, are shown to change their own behavior, anticipating what these institutions expect from them. So Joseph K. basically comes to accept that he is guilty and that he is the accused, so that by the final chapter, he's already awaiting his executioners dressed in his best suit, wearing new gloves. So it's that sort of insidious effect of the kind of mind games that these institutions play with us, where we think we are free to make choices and we are not.
Well, unlike Kay, I have a guide. So, Caroline, I was wondering, maybe I could ask you as co-curator of this exhibition to just sort of imagine taking me by the hand and just leading me through the exhibition.
Right. So as you come in, there will be a big panel which has a quote from one of Kafka's two letters that he wrote abroad instructing him to destroy all of his unpublished manuscripts. So this is basically the opening to the exhibition, the sense that this is a work that was not meant to survive, as Richard said earlier. The exhibition then takes you through Kafka's life in all its different facets. It starts with Prague, with his family life, with his very constricted living situation, which he found very difficult and claustrophobic. And then it shows how Kafka has this double identity as a writer and as a lawyer. So there is a case which has the manuscript of a short story called The Judgment, which was Kafka's breakthrough story, which he famously wrote in one single sitting over the course of one night, and which really marks the beginning of his mature work. So this is really an absolute landmark moment for Kafka. We've then got cases which talk about Kafka's rather neurotic relationship to his body and his health. So his obsession with various like kind of lifestyle programs. He was a strict vegetarian. He did naked exercise by the window every single day, which he kept up for much of his life. And then we tell the story of his illness, the kind of medical history surrounding tuberculosis at the time, what sort of treatment Kafka would have undergone. And then the second half of the exhibition is really about fleshing out the title, which is Making of an Icon. So it's about Kafka's huge posthumous career as, a world author. So one of the real centerpieces of the exhibition is Andy Warhol's portrait of Kafka, which was part of his portrait series about Jewish intellectuals. And this portrait will be displayed alongside various photographs of Kafka himself. So a lot of this will be about Kafka's image in popular culture. And then also it'll be about how Kafka has inspired authors, choreographers, visual artists, musicians, people working across the whole range of media who have taken up his ideas, his themes, his works, and turned them into something, made them their own. So in that sense, it's really about Kafka's global legacy today.
Maybe, Caroline and Richard, you could just leave listeners who might be encountering Kafka for the first time with your tips as to where they should begin. If you could recommend one place to begin, where would it be?
So I think really for anyone who's never encountered Kafka, I would recommend The Metamorphoses.
The chief clerk now raised his voice. Mr. Samsa, he called to him, what is wrong? You barricade yourself in your room, give us no more than yes or no for an answer. You are causing serious and unnecessary concern to your parents, and you fail, and I mentioned this just by the way, you fail to carry out your business duties in a way that is quite unheard of. I'm speaking here on behalf of your parents and of your employer, and really must request a clear and immediate explanation. I am astonished, quite astonished. I thought I knew you as a calm and sensible person, and now you seem to be showing off with peculiar whims.
But I would also strongly recommend that people dive into his other short stories. There's a real treasure trove of, you know, tales about all manner of things, about animals, about people, about faraway places, even about talking objects. So probably my all-time favorite Kafka story is a story called The Cares of the Householder, or Odradek, which is about this little thing creature that lives in the attic and that cannot be captured. And it's not even really clear what this creature looks like, but basically it's a sort of, you know, it's almost the physical embodiment of the Kafkaesque, I would say.
I couldn't agree more. I would definitely recommend starting with The Metamorphosis and moving on from there. But I'd also, of course, recommend coming to see the exhibition, which Caroline and her colleagues have co-curated here in Oxford. It's open from end of May, from the 30th of May through to the end of October. It then moves to New York, so you'll have a chance to see it in the Morgan Library there.
Wonderful. Well, Caroline, Richard, thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. It was lovely.
Our guides this half hour have been Caroline Duttlinger, Professor of German Literature and Culture, co-curator of the Bodleian Exhibition and co-director of the Oxford Kafka Research Centre. Also, Richard Ovenden, who has the delicious title of Bodley's Librarian.
No one else could enter this door. This door was intended only for you. Now, I am going to close it. This tale is told during the story called The Trial. It has been said that the logic of this story is the logic of a dream.
And just a reminder that although the Kafka Making of an Icon exhibition has now closed in Oxford, it is about to open in New York on November 22nd at the Morgan Library and Museum on Madison Avenue. My thanks this week go to Sam Baker and sound technicians Moritz Vogt, Timon Heidorn and Siad Abu Sleiman. Also a personal thank you to Anchor Rasper. We'll be back within our usual current affairs remit next week. For now, though, we do hope that you enjoyed the show. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.